I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later in the program, we find out the latest from Yemen, whose president has been counted as a U.S. ally, even as anti-Western terrorist groups are believed to have based operations there. Now, as the anti-government protests that have swept the Arab world reach that country, there's talk of civil war. We'll get perspective from Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, and from Washington. But first, back to a pressing but less visible crisis here at home. This Sunday is the day, 30 years ago, that HIV/AIDS was first recognized as a distinct disease. Back then, patients who were diagnosed with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, were essentially living out a death sentence. They were told there was nothing that could be done for them. But the development of powerful drugs have allowed millions of HIV-positive people to lead long and productive lives. Now, we've talked often on this program about the quest to get these life-enhancing medicines into the hands of people around the world. However, the drugs also remain out of reach for many Americans. Last week, The Washington Post reported a record number of people are on state waiting lists to help them get and pay for the drugs that treat HIV/AIDS. More than 8,300 people across the country. Thomas Decker is on one of those waiting lists in Virginia. He's lived with HIV since 1992. Since January of this year, he's been lucky enough to get his medication through a voluntary program run by a pharmaceutical company. But if the company decides to stop that program and the state doesn't select him for government help, what will he do?
I guess the other option is board a bus and go to Canada or Mexico. Most drugs are, even for older people, are prohibitively expensive, let alone any of your HIV/AIDS medications. You're talking $4,000 or more a month, which is, you know, it's not feasible.
We caught up with Thomas Decker of Virginia with the help of the Washington Post. But we want to turn now to the state with the highest number of people on the HIV/AIDS drug waiting list, Florida. The state also has one of the highest rates of new infection in the country. We wanted to find out how HIV-positive patients are faring in that state, so we've called Thomas Liberti. He's chief of Florida's Bureau of HIV/AIDS. That's within the state's Department of Health. He's managed public health programs in Florida for more than 35 years. He joins us now from WFSU in Tallahassee. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Jason King, a patient advocate and pharmacy specialist with AIDS Healthcare Foundation in Florida. His organization treats patients who have HIV and AIDS and also advocates for funding and services. He's at member station WLRN in Miami. And welcome to you, Jason. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
So, Thomas Liberti, let me start with you. Do you know why the waiting list is so long in Florida?
Well, there have been a number of factors going on in our state along with other parts of the country for the last 4 years. As been reported in the past, we really have the perfect storm going on in the United States and in Florida. We have a long and deep ongoing recession. We have flat funding from the federal government on the money that we get for purchasing the drugs for the AIDS Drug Assistance Program. We have flat funding or reduced funding in some states from the general revenue standpoint. We have a massive amount of unemployment. Our unemployment in the state of Florida was approximately 4.5% before the recession, and we peaked at 12.3%, which included 1.1 million Floridians. We also have 4 million Floridians without health insurance in our state. The National Institute of Health guidelines changed about a year and a half ago, encouraging more early treatment for HIV. And from 2006, most states expanded their counseling and testing programs using the rapid HIV test and routine testing, so more people are coming forward knowing their HIV status earlier.
So you've got more people wanting the drugs, more people being told they should get the drugs. Less money, less insurance, just as you said, a perfect storm. And you recently announced, your office recently announced a proposal to change the income eligibility for the AIDS drug program that people would have to make less than $21,000 annually to qualify for it. As I understand it, hundreds of people came to the public hearings, were very impassioned in their opposition to that change. I'll just read one comment from a woman who identified herself as Karen. She came and said, you know, I can't afford a job. As a mother, I have to choose. I have to provide for my children, keep a roof over their heads, give them food. But if I choose to be self-sufficient, my children will slowly watch me die. So, Mr. Liberti, what do you say to somebody like that?
Well, Florida is following a number of steps that other states also are following in the cost containment business of ADAP. Exactly 1 year ago today, we did close the program to new enrollees. A few months after that, we reduced the formulary for HIV drugs from approximately 100 to 50. And one of the things that we did not do was lower the eligibility. So for the last 6 months, we've been exploring the issue of should we, could we, or would we actually lower the eligibility in the state of Florida. We had four public hearings, two in Miami, one in Tampa, and one in Tallahassee, where over 1,000 people came to testify, and it was crystal clear that pretty much 100% of them was opposed to the state reducing the eligibility down to 200%, which would affect about 1,560 individuals. It is actually not our public health recommendation to do that, and we have not filed a rule yet to reduce eligibility in the state of Florida.
So, Jason King, my guess is the people who find themselves in this situation are probably turning to you. What are the people doing who are on the waiting list now? Do they have other sources of medication, or what are they doing?
Well, currently the only option for these patients is to apply directly to the pharmaceutical companies, and that's what I help patients do all day long. And the process can be rather time-consuming. Patients actually have to fill out multiple applications to appeal to all the different manufacturers. Say if you have a patient who's on four different medications that complete their regimen, they have to apply to each one of those manufacturers that produces those different drugs. And every manufacturer has a different income criteria, a different procedure, a different wait time. It could take sometimes weeks for a patient to get all of his or her medication.
And so is it your sense that people are just not taking any medication or not getting any treatment at all while this process goes forward? Is that what you think is happening?
Well, I'll use myself as an example. Before actually being familiar with these programs, I didn't know that they existed. And certainly you could imagine that people do slip through the cracks and don't even realize that they can make use of these programs and still obtain their medication regardless of the fact that the ADAP has an implemented wait list. So, yes, we do suspect that there are many people that just do not have either the mobility or the wherewithal to get to a patient advocate or a case manager to apply for these programs. So people are possibly not taking their medication.
And just as a sense of the scope of this, if you don't mind disclosing this, you told us, I hope you don't mind telling us, how much your medication would cost if you did not have, if you weren't enrolled in some program, Jason.
Not at all. I don't mind talking about it. I did a calculation. The two medications that I take are Truvada and Isentress, and I take them every day. And over the course of the year, they can amount to approximately $30,000 without insurance.
That could be the total. That could wipe out your entire income.
Absolutely. And so, with the possibility of a eligibility reduction, it would be absolutely impossible on my income to be able to afford those medications if I did not have insurance. Fortunately, I do, so I don't have to worry about that. But there are many patients who either have medication regimens where the medication is not covered by their insurance. I just worked with a patient the other day whose one of his medications was not covered, and we did have to apply for patient assistance. And I only take two medications. Keep in mind, we have patients that are sometimes on five different HIV medications. I mean, you could just imagine the astronomical cost of that expenditure.
And Thomas Liberti, just to clarify, now these programs, these AIDS drug assistance programs, ADAPs, are not entitlement programs. It's not that if you meet certain criteria, you have to be enrolled in the program. That's right?
That is correct. It is not similar to food stamps or Medicaid enrollee if you become eligible, which is an entitlement program. Each state gets an allocation from the federal government through the Ryan White Care Act and also applies general revenue money or rebate money to come up with their ADAP budget across the United States. And as we calculate that, then we can figure out approximately how many patients we can take care of each year. Prior to this past crisis with the economy, Florida's ADAP program was open and did not have a wait list for 14 consecutive years. So we were able, in the previous environment, to have enough federal and state money with an active Medicaid program to take care of the amount of patients. Unfortunately, we're not at that situation right now.
And finally, we only have about a minute and a half left, Mr. Liberti, so I'm going to ask you, what's the worst-case scenario here?
I'm not sure what the worst-case scenario is. I feel like things are getting a little bit better. We're going to do three things to make sure that we help people with HIV and AIDS. We're going to continue to advocate and secure additional funding from the federal government. we're going to maintain, restore, and increase resources for ADAP at the state level, and we're going to continue to work hard with agreements with the pharmaceutical manufacturers to provide stability, and we're going to argue that lower prices are needed.
And Jason, only a minute left for you. What's your final thought here? What's your worst case scenario? Do you think it is going to get better?
I certainly hope so, and I do have faith in Tom Liberty's guidance. The last thing that we would need to do in the case of the reduction of eligibility is take people to Tallahassee and hope this doesn't go through.
Jason King is a pharmacy specialist and patient advocate at AIDS Healthcare Foundation in Florida. He was with us from member station WLRN in Miami. Thomas Liberty is chief of Florida's HIV/AIDS Bureau. He joined us from WFSU in Tallahassee. I thank you both so much for joining us. Good luck to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. FIFA is the world governing body of soccer. Judging from widespread allegations of bribery and corruption, one would think FIFA is in a state of crisis. But not according to Sepp Blatter, the president of FIFA, who was re-elected today to a fourth term. He was asked about a crisis at a news conference in Zurich on Monday.
Crisis? Yes. What is a crisis? If somebody of you would describe to me what there is a crisis, then I would answer. Football is not in a crisis.
Well, crisis or not, Blatter was re-elected without facing an opponent today. His only rival withdrew less than a week ago under allegations of impropriety. The English and Scottish football associations urged a postponement of that vote, but the representatives of many other national soccer federations warmly supported Blatter. Well, joining us from Zurich is sports reporter Alex Kapstick of the BBC. And Alex, would you say FIFA is in a crisis?
Well, lots of people would say FIFA is in a crisis, but the members don't think so, although they realise they have had a difficult time and change is required. And I think Sepp Blatter thinks that as well, although he won't, as you heard, go as far to admit that the organisation, an organisation he has been in charge of for 13 years, he's just entering his final four-year term, but he won't go as far to say that it's crisis, that it's in terminal decline. He thinks he's the man to lead them out of the choppy waters, as he described them, and the members have trusted him in that.
Now, shortly after his re-election, Blatter moved towards one change for FIFA. Rather than letting only the 24 members of the executive committee vote on which countries get to host the World Cup, he would have all 208 soccer federations vote. Is that likely to be an improvement or just more opportunity for vote selling?
Well, he said that the current corruption allegations of bribery and the problems they've experienced over the past few days, weeks and months all stems from the way the 2018 and 2022 World Cups were decided. Now, in the past, World Cups have been chosen by the 24-man ruling executive committee. It was only 22 men last December because two of them had been suspended over allegations of bribery in the build-up to that World Cup. So that was a problem. And then countries that didn't do so well in that process, such as Australia, the United States, and indeed England, made a few complaints that they felt it might not have been fair. England, for example, had been praised by Sepp Blatter as having a very good bid. So what Sepp Blatter has done, he hasn't admitted that those processes were flawed. Mm-hmm. However, to make the organisation more transparent, he says, he wants to, and to give the national associations more power, he's going to let the associations decide which countries host the World Cup. The executive committee will make up a shortlist, but they won't recommend any of them. And the 208 national associations will sit down and decide what to do, who should get the World Cup.
Now, Mohammed bin Hamman, the man who withdrew from the race against Sepp Blatter, leaving this, making Blatter's re-election something unopposed, he had been involved in getting the games for his country, Qatar, the World Cup in 2022. The president of the German Football Federation has called upon FIFA to re-examine its award of those games to Qatar. Is there any serious possibility of the federation revisiting that and changing the site of the games, or once they make a decision, is it obviously going to stick?
Well, Sepp Blatter has said there was nothing wrong with the bids 2018 or 2022, and he's ruled out any revision of that process. They will not have another vote to see who stages the 2022 World Cup. But now the head of the German Federation has asked for that process to be revised. Then FIFA will have to answer his question.
Alex Kapstick of the BBC, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alex Kapstick, a sports reporter for the BBC, spoke to us from Zurich, where FIFA today re-elected President Sepp Blatter by an overwhelming majority.
Ellen Willis, who died in 2006, was part of the first generation of critics to take rock and pop music seriously and write about it with both erudition and passion. A feminist with a populist streak, Willis has often all but been forgotten in discussions of rock criticism until now. Out of the Vinyl Deeps, Ellen Willis on Rock Music, an anthology of her groundbreaking work, has just been published by the University of Minnesota Press. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Ellen Willis was one of the first rock critics at a time starting in the late 60s when serious writing about rock, pop, and R&B was rare. She was the first pop music critic for The New Yorker, starting in 1968. She combined a love of pop culture and an active engagement with feminist theory to create a unique body of writing, which finally gets a proper showcase in Out of the Vinyl Deeps, Ellen Willis on Rock Music, edited by her daughter, Nona Willis Aronowitz.
They're selling postcards of the hanging. They're painting the passports brown. The beauty parlors filled with sailors. The circus is in town. Here comes the blind commissioner. They've got him in a trance. One hand is tied to the tightrope walker. The other is in his pants. And the riot squad, they're restless. They need somewhere to go. As Lady and I look out tonight from Desolation Row.
The anthology leads off with a remarkable dissection of Bob Dylan circa 1967. Typical of this long piece, which appeared in a short-lived pop magazine called Cheetah, were assertions about her subject that no one had ventured before, yet which afterward became common wisdom. Quote, "His masks hidden by other masks, Dylan is the celebrity stalker's ultimate antagonist." To have seen this in Dylan in 1967, at a time when he was very much a public pop star, is typical of Willis's close listening to songs, adding everything she knew about the subject's public image and private life to arrive at a critical position. Willis loved stars from Dylan to Janis Joplin, but she also championed cult bands such as Joy of Cooking and the New York Dolls. Her judgments were never predictable. She argued that the Rolling Stones' diatribe Under My Thumb was less sexist than Cat Stevens' condescending Wild World because, quote, "Mick Jagger's fantasy of sweet revenge could easily be female as well as male." Writing with a directness and utter lack of fan gush, many of Willis's observations sound as fresh, as appropriate to the present music scene, as they did decades ago. Her 1971 criticism of pop music's tendency, both among the audience and the critic, toward, quote, a tedious worship of technical proficiency, would be as appropriate now regarding TV shows such as American Idol and The Voice as it was in addressing music on vinyl back then. At a certain point, post-punk, around the time hip-hop became the dominant sound of popular music, Willis lost interest in rock criticism and pursued other interests. Feminist theory and activism, politics, and the philosophy of Wilhelm Reich, among many other topics. She'd become impatient with pop in part for its failure as an agent of social and political change, writing, quote, "There can't be a revolutionary culture until there's a revolution." She was the founder of New York University's Cultural Reporting and Criticism Program, and by many accounts, an inspirational teacher. Willis died in 2006 at age 64. Out of the vinyl deeps, whether she's writing about Elvis Presley or Moby Grape, resurrects a nearly lost, vital, invaluable voice.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Out of the Vinyl Deeps, Ellen Willis on rock music. Join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
We have a review for you now for a new novel from science fiction writer Ben Bova. In his latest effort, Bova returns to familiar territory, the vast and mysterious ocean of Jupiter. Here's Alan Chews.
Ben Bova is an old science fiction hand with scores of novels and stories published under his name. This latest book, Leviathans of Jupiter, just out, is in fact the sequel to his 2001 novel, Jupiter, in which we learn that a team of scientists has discovered what may be intelligent life in the strange body of water laced with ammonia and sulfur compounds that makes up the ocean of Jupiter, an ocean 10 times wider than the entire planet Earth, Bova informs us. But enough of the science lecture. The rest of the novel comes as pure entertainment as a crew descends into the near toxic fluid of this sea and the mountain-sized creatures they dub the Leviathans make contact with them. While, of course, some interplanetary political intrigue may stop the entire project in mid-flight. If you love speculative science fiction, you'll enjoy this one no end. Musing on the nature of life, the possibilities of space travel, and both the retrograde and expansive elements of human nature.
The book is Leviathans of Jupiter by Ben Bova. Our reviewer, Alan Chews, teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. His latest novel is called Songs of Slaves in the Desert.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Last year's GOP takeover of the U.S. House, as well as state houses across the country, dramatically changed the nation's abortion debate. Already this year, states have passed dozens of laws restricting the procedure, and an effort to strip funding from Planned Parenthood nearly shut down the federal government last month. As NPR's Julie Rovner reports, all this change has given a boost to an even more far-reaching effort to legally redefine when life begins.
When life begins, of course, is a theological question. The legal question is when someone becomes a person. But even that varies under the law, says Alexa Colby Molinas. She's an attorney with the ACLU.
The definition of personhood ranges if you're talking about property law.
That would include things like real estate and personal property.
Or inheritance.
Say a grandparent dies. Can a fetus share in the proceeds of the will?
Or how the census is taken.
Who exactly gets counted? All those differences are exactly what Keith Mason wants to change. He's president of Personhood USA, a group that's trying to rewrite the laws and constitutions of every state to recognize someone as a person. Here's how he puts it.
It's exactly at creation, it's fertilization, or it's when the sperm meets the egg.
Mason says the basic problem is that science has advanced faster than policymaking.
We know, without a shadow of a doubt, when human life begins. But our laws have not caught up to what we know.
And according to his organization, those laws should recognize every fertilized egg as an individual and complete human being.
At the heart of what we're doing is saying that being human is enough to have rights and privileges to live, and all humans should be considered persons.
But while that fertilized egg may or may not signal the beginning of personhood, there's one thing it definitely does not begin. Medically, at least, fertilization does not mark the beginning of pregnancy. Dan Grossman is an OBGYN at the University of California, San Francisco.
The medical community has really been quite clear about when pregnancy begins. And that definition is really that pregnancy begins once implantation occurs.
That would be the implantation of the fertilized egg into the woman's uterus. One reason doctors don't consider a woman pregnant until after implantation is a practical one. That's when it can be detected by hormone changes in her urine. But there's another reason, Grossman says.
It's really only about half of those fertilized eggs actually result in an ongoing pregnancy.
Meaning they either never begin dividing or never implant, or they do implant but spontaneously abort. That can happen so early in pregnancy, the woman never even knows she was pregnant. So from a medical point of view, considering every fertilized egg a person with a person's full rights wouldn't make a lot of sense, he says. But if Personhood USA succeeds, Grossman says, it could threaten the use of a long list of commonly used contraceptives, including some birth control pills and the IUD, among others.
This redefinition really could end up reclassifying all of these effective and safe birth control methods as abortifacients or agents that induce abortion.
That's because some of those methods may act not only to prevent fertilization, but if fertilization does occur, to prevent that fertilized egg from implanting in a woman's uterus. But does that equal an abortion?
And it's certainly not a view that's held by the medical profession or that's based on medical evidence. And it's certainly not consistent with what American women and couples want and use to plan their families.
But ACLU attorney Alexa Colby Molinas says that banning forms of birth control along with abortion is exactly what the personhood backers want.
Their intention is to ban abortion. Their intention is to ban some of the most commonly used forms of birth control.
Personhood USA President Keith Mason doesn't deny that.
Certainly women, my wife included, would want to know if the pills that they're taking would in fact kill a unique human individual. And I think there's a lot of misinformation about that.
Colby Molinas also says declaring a fertilized egg a person could have more far-reaching and even potentially dangerous consequences by legally separating a woman from her pregnancy. Take, for example, a potentially life-threatening ectopic pregnancy. That's where a fertilized egg implants outside the uterus.
Ectopic pregnancies are not viable pregnancies. And so it is essential that an ectopic pregnancy be terminated as soon as possible. But by giving all fertilized eggs legal rights under the law, that calls into question what kind of methods a doctor can actually use to save a woman's life in a situation like this.
And it's not just medical questions raised by personhood laws. There's still more legal questions. Would pregnant women be counted as two people for purposes of using carpool lanes on the highway? Could fetuses inherit property? Arguments like that helped defeat personhood amendments in Colorado in 2008 and 2010, but Mason isn't giving up. Voters in Mississippi could vote on a personhood amendment to their state constitution this November, although the ACLU is challenging that initiative in court. Personhood USA hopes to get proposals on the ballot in nearly half the states by 2012. Julie Rovner, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel.
I started singing, but I like this American pie. We shed it to the levee, but the levee is dry.
That's Don McLean's song, American Pie, and it figures prominently in our next story. A Michigan city is trying to put a positive spin on a negative story published by Newsweek earlier this year. As Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith reports, the people of Grand Rapids have put together a remarkable music video set to American Pie, and it's getting rave reviews.
It was late January when Newsweek published a seemingly innocuous article listing America's top 10 dying cities. The list was based on total population loss and the loss of those residents younger than 18. It's really no surprise that three of those cities were in Michigan, which was hammered hard by the recession. Detroit, Flint, and Grand Rapids all made the list. So what can you do to refute that your city isn't really dying? Here's what these guys in Grand Rapids did.
If you're a featured extra or a featured character, stay where you are. Otherwise, we need extras in Rosa Parks Circle. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Joe Pesch.
I'm Paul Lengeski. We're definitely trying to get used to how fast we have to go to keep up with the camera today.
Joe and Paul are two of the nearly 5,000 people who took part in the Grand Rapids Lipped Up video. Just imagine a whole lot of people singing karaoke to the same song at the same time. The hard part is shooting a video of them lip-syncing the song in a continuous shot. One take, no edits. It's kind of the holy grail of videos, and it's not easy.
I'm Nick Lavelle. We're all part of the crew. And it's our job to manage and organize our separate event areas. We have a section with the fire department, a section with pillow fighters, a section with zombie fighters. All of these different events need to be organized across Grand Rapids.
There's also a section of the Lipped Up with kayakers, Nerf gun shooters, marching bands, explosions, even a helicopter takeoff.
My name is George Hartwell. I'm the mayor of Grand Rapids, the greatest city in the galaxy. And my role in Lip Dub is to ride in the back of this car.
We sing.
And there we were all in one place. A generation lost in space with no time left to start again.
Yeah.
Okay, fortunately, so, this is a Lip Dub, and and Don McLean will be singing it instead of us.
Hartwell has been railing on Newsweek ever since it published the Dying Cities list. Here he is in his State of the City speech.
Just last July, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce awarded Grand Rapids its Siemens Award for the most sustainable mid-sized city in America. Now, put that in your pipe, Newsweek, and smoke it.
Grand Rapids' population did decline over the past 10 years by about 2%. But the Lipped Up video's director, Rob Bliss, says that certainly doesn't mean Grand Rapids is dying, though in making his point, he insults another Michigan city.
Its culture is growing so rapidly that I think that's what just surprised people. I think Flint was like 9 or something like that. So to think that we're just like a step away from Flint, I think was ridiculous.
Bliss and his buddy Scott Erickson had to raise close to $40,000 to pull off the Lipped Up video. When it was released late last week, fans plastered the Lipped Up all over Newsweek's Facebook page. Newsweek quickly issued a statement on their page asking people to spread the word that the magazine loves Grand Rapids. Their editorial staff doesn't agree with the Dying Cities list, that they didn't even create it, only published it through a content sharing deal with another website. Considering the video has over a million views, Erickson says they don't even care Newsweek hasn't said the words, "We're sorry." Don McLean is the original singer-songwriter of American Pie. The rock folk song topped the charts for a month in 1971. Now, 40 years later, film critic Roger Ebert is calling the Grand Rapids music video the best ever made. For NPR News, I'm Lindsay Smith in Grand Rapids.
And you can see the Grand Rapids Lipped Up video at npr.org.